And good morning. It is just around 9 o'clock here on KKFI, 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning, and you know what that is. It's time for Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Beth Pike, and I'd like to welcome you to the show. And then we'll be hearing today, on this edition, our host Rebecca Hamilton is going to be talking with Kristen Chow and also Brittany Coleman, who are founding members of One Struggle KC. And they're going to tell you about how racism is institutionalized in our society and also answer your questions, too. And then, in place of the calendar this week, Jeff Humfeld will talk with Melissa Styler, who is coordinator of the Cross Border Network. And they're going to be talking about a caravan that's coming here to Kansas City with 16 parents of the 43 Normalista students. And those are the students that disappeared in Iguala, Guerrero, Mexico back in September of 2014. And they'll talk about what happened to their children and how it's connected and to the, you know, to the U.S. war on drugs. So she will give us the schedule of events for the caravan's visit. And then, as always, we've got the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. But coming up next will be Rebecca and her guest after these messages on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Good morning. My name is Rebecca Hamilton. I'm pleased to have two members of the One Struggle KC organization. I have Kristen Chow and Brittany Coleman. I've asked both to be here to tell us a little bit about how they became organizers and activists and what led them to become part of the One Struggle KC group. At the end, we'll be talking a little bit about plans for the future, upcoming events, and we'll give y'all a chance to call in and ask them questions and find out more about how you can be involved. I attended a community forum that was organized by One Struggle shortly after it was announced that there would be no indictment in the Michael Brown killing. And I was very impressed with what the organization did. They provided a forum for people to express their anger, their frustration, and to sort of give people a chance to know how to go forward from there. And I've been impressed with the group of how they have organized community activism and their purpose, their goals. So I wanted to ask you, I'll start with you, Kristen. How did you become involved as an activist, and what led you to this place?
Well, I initially became involved in activism through the immigrant rights movement and the push for the passage of the DREAM Act, which occurred around 2010-2012. And, of course, as a lot of people know, the DREAM Act was a piece of federal legislation that would have normalized the status of undocumented children who were brought here at early ages. And so that's how I kind of got involved, and I stayed involved, you know, through the years, even though the DREAM Act did not pass. President Obama did end up enacting an executive order that essentially accomplished the same goals. And so that led me to, I mean, that sort of sparked my interest in activism. I never, you know, thought I'd be on organizing a organization here in Kansas City, but what happened was that when the Michael Brown killing took place, I was involved with the National Guild here in Kansas City, and the weekend after following his death, the president put out a call to see who wanted to go down to Ferguson, and you know, I didn't know what to expect or even whether I wanted to go, and it was sort of a last minute decision. And within about 3 hours of deciding to go down, we were on the road to Ferguson, and stayed down there about 3 days. And again, I really didn't know what to expect, and what we were seeing on TV were, you know, pictures of people, you know, pretty much lawlessness, and people were being painted as, you know, looters and rioters. And we arrived in Ferguson that, I think it was Friday night or something, and it was just an emotional, overwhelming emotionally, because what we were seeing on TV was not what was not the sentiment when we arrived. And I was just overcome with emotion when we, you know, were driving down the main strip in Ferguson. And in the days that followed, it was, you know, a very warm and welcoming environment. It was just the epitome of, like, community. People were taking care of each other, feeding each other, and, you know, picking up trash around the quick trip that, you know, was being shown on TV. And it was just really inspiring, and came back and didn't really know what to do, but felt that something needed to be done, because, you know, me and some of my friends didn't see anything being done in Kansas City, and, you know, which is not that far from Ferguson. And so we came together over drinks, the happy hour drinks, and decided to form One Struggle. And that's how it kind of got started.
All right. Let's talk to Brittany. Can you tell us what brought you to this place as an activist?
Yes. Hi, I'm Brittany. And my story is a little bit different, but it kind of ends up the same with Kristen's. Activism for me really got started when I was in college. The first time I remember actively being involved was when Genesis 6 happened. And to familiarize people with that story, it was the town of Jenna, and there were 6 African-American high school student boys who were involved in getting these charges that were extremely trumped up for a fight on their school grounds. And when it happened, I was a junior in college, and I just could not believe that they were facing these tremendously long sentences. And I was in college. I was overwhelmed. I was interested in going into the legal field, and it was the first time that I felt this overwhelming sense to protest, to create signs, to be on a college campus where I was already feeling marginalized, and I wanted to protest. And that was the first time I did it. After that, I went on to law school, and then Trayvon Martin happened. And after Trayvon Martin was killed, that was the next time I wanted to protest. And I was never involved with a formal organization, but, you know, there were just small times that activism was a part of, was more frequently becoming a part of who I was. When Mike Brown was killed, I was working, but I remember being home that night and taking to Twitter, and it was the first time that I was able to actually see things as they were happening because of Twitter. I had friends that were constantly updating their accounts and saying, this is what's happening on the ground in live action. And because of live stream, then I felt like I was able to be a part of the process as it was real time occurring. Social media really allowed people who were not in Ferguson to feel like they were getting the quick updates and be a part of what was going on without the mainstream media. And that made the process so much easier, so much real for those of us outside of that community. And it made me feel very, very connected, especially since I had never been a part of a formal organization. And it drew me in instantly. So
was that different from Trayvon Martin and other experiences, was the fact that you could now be live on the scene? Did that make a difference?
It did. I always felt connected to those, but because I was in school at the time, I could never physically go to those locations. Mm-hmm. And with Ferguson being so close, it was, and me being able to live stream it, mm-hmm. it was something that I felt like I have to go. I have to be there. And it was within, I don't know, hours, I was on Facebook saying, you know, I have to go to Ferguson. We're too close. And that's how I found other friends who were saying the exact same things from Kansas City. We want to go to Ferguson too. This is in our same state. We have to do this. And I had some other friends who felt the same way. They were just as affected. And we made our way to Ferguson as well.
Tell us about what you saw and experienced in Ferguson.
Now that, my experience was very similar to Kristen's. Mm-hmm. And at this point, I had never met her, and we did not go to Ferguson at the same time. But the devastation of the community, and when I say devastation, I mean devastation of the people of color that have been experiencing police brutality, was alarming. People who felt like they had nothing left to lose because they had just been terrorized by the people who were supposed to be protecting them. You saw that in people's faces. But then you also saw people who finally felt like the world cared about them. Mm-hmm. And it was so close to Kansas City, and I had never experienced anything like that in my life. For the days that I was down there, I finally felt like I was around people that were inspiring me to do what I was supposed to be doing my whole life. Mm-hmm. And up to that point, I thought I was, had gone to school, followed my legal career. I thought I knew what I was supposed to be doing. And it wasn't until I went to Ferguson that I finally started finding myself. And they helped me do that.
So you've found what your life had led you to in that experience. Is that also true for you, Kristen?
Yeah, like I said, I'd been involved in the immigrant rights movement, but of course that doesn't directly affect me personally. But this hit home. Mm-hmm. Because I have a brother who's African American. I have friends and colleagues who are African American who have experienced the exact same thing, police brutality, all their lives. And so this was very personal. And I think I always say that one struggle was, came to fruition out of love and love of community and, love of our people. And so it was really, it was really personal and really, solidified, my direction in terms of activism.
What did either of you feel the community in Ferguson wanted from you? How did they respond to you being there? What were they asking of you?
They asked that we bring that message back to our individual communities. What we experienced when we were there is that we teach the message, and every experience that we were learning, we gained a lot of training there in Ferguson, that we bring that back to every city. There were so many people that we met, individual activists from all over the country, all over the world, actually, and that we go back, teach everyone what we were learning, teach them about police brutality, about state violence, but then we share those messages with our communities and help our communities that are suffering the exact same forms of police brutality, state violence.
Anything to add to that?
No, I agree. It's the same thing that I experienced.
Tell us about training that you received there.
So we received some very specific training regarding direct actions. And
Well, tell us more specifically. Direct action, that means on the street, right?
Direct actions refers to how to structure when you are having a protest or how when you are having medic training, when you have any type of action that you want to state a purpose and you want to gain the general public's attention. So training in how you organize those activities so that you can get more of the general public's attention,
right.
How you structure those actions.
And you've put that training into practice in One Struggle activities. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. We have had three actions up to this, or three trainings, I guess I should say, up to this point. So a lot of that training came directly from Ferguson and what we were taught there. The information has been crucial to the Kansas City community. We've had a lot of people come out who have never participated in protest or any forms of action, and the training is extremely educational. It keeps people safe. It makes them feel more comfortable before they participate in any actions so that they know exactly what to expect. And again, it makes people feel safe and makes them feel part of the community. So that they know that there are people that understand exactly what their fears are before stepping out into an action.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I agree. And actually, the training that I received the first time I went down to Ferguson was through the National Lawyers Guild, and it was legal observing. And so the direct action training that I received was actually from Brittany and Tiffany the first time we met them. And so, you know, that just goes to show that, like, the members bring various, you know, experiences and expertise.
So the National Lawyers Guild provided training for how to be an observer, primarily. Is that the training that you got?
Right.
And so what kind of things go into that training? What specifically?
That training is, the core of that training is to watch the police and to make sure that the rights of protesters aren't violated by the police. And that's exactly what we were doing when we went down the first weekend.
And how are you taught to respond if you see things that appear to be over the line and people's rights being violated?
To document, okay. To record and document. I have to say that I haven't been back to Ferguson as much as I like, but I'm still on the listserv for the NLG down there, and they have been on it in documenting cases and violations, and there are some court cases that have come up regarding the violation of the civil rights of protesters down there, and the protesters have gained some victories. And I think that's largely due to the fact that the National Lawyers Guild has really been on point in terms of you know, making sure the rights of protesters are protected.
Do you incorporate any of that idea of documentation, of observing? Has that been incorporated into the training that you do here in Kansas City?
The Guild has done several training sessions here in Kansas City, and it's been helpful to us, particularly in our highway action, because seven people got arrested that day, and it was crucial the video documentation as well as the written documentation of people who got arrested and, you know, going to jail and providing jail support and getting those people out the night of the action. So, yeah.
All right. So in your view, were the seven people that were arrested, were they was there a basis for that arrest, or do they contest the legality of what happened there?
We think our position is that it was there were some you know, violations committed, and all cases have been settled as of this point for those people. And yes, there were some violations. We have some personal stories that came out of that particular situation that are just absolutely atrocious as to police misconduct, even after the arrest.
All right. And when was that action?
December 20th.
Okay, and tell me a little more about how it was organized and how it was carried out.
So the December 20th action was called KC Parade Action. And the purpose of the action was to bring in the Kansas City community and to really call, it was a call for action for Kansas City to stand in solidarity with Ferguson. This was one of the first major actions here for Kansas City to show that we do stand in complete solidarity. We are Ferguson. And to show our sister city that, yes, we are here. Kansas City is not silent. We will not be silent. And we, in fact, do understand the same struggles that are going on in Ferguson are going on here in Kansas City as well, that black and brown lives matter here in Kansas City. They matter in Ferguson. They matter all over the world. And we will not be silenced.
And how was it carried out? What happened?
We had a short rally beforehand at Parade Park. And afterwards, we carried banners onto the exit ramp
of I-70.
I-70.
Okay. And the purpose behind that, and the purpose behind the whole shut it down hashtag for the Black Lives Matters movement is to deliberately disrupt lives. Racism and police brutality disrupts lives of black and brown people every day. And a lot of people are oblivious to that. And the purpose of shutting stuff down is to call attention to that, to cause minor disruptions so that people sit and think about how racism affects people, how racism affects their lives, even though they may not even be aware of it.
So this reminds me, tell me if this is connected to struggles like this throughout history. I'm thinking of, the Freedom Riders and other groups that have done maybe similar type of action.
Right, I agree. It's the use of civil disobedience to raise the consciousness of the community, of the country, and to call attention from a humanitarian standpoint to, human rights issues. And so I personally draw inspiration from the movements of the 60s. And I think a lot of the techniques that we use have been inspired by those movements as well.
How does that feel to be there, knowing that it's civil disobedience, that there's going to be reaction, and in fact, you're asking for a reaction, you're disrupting. How does that feel?
It's a range of emotions, honestly. It can be scary at times. It can be exhilarating, but most of all, it's liberating and it's revolutionary. When you know that you are fighting for people's right to exist, then that overrides the feeling of fear. Because at the end of the day, this is about people's right to live. And people's right to live and exist simply because of the color of their skin.
What kind of reaction have you gotten, not just from the police, which I take it to be mixed at best, from the public as you engage in these types of actions?
I mean, I've felt nothing but support, and I think people here are hungry for this. What has been particularly meaningful for me is to have the support of the elders of the community who have been doing this for decades. And that has been the most meaningful to me, to have them come to us and say, we need you all to continue to do this, that we can't be out there anymore, but the issues are still there, and we need you to keep doing what you're doing.
Angry. I know that there's more to this type of organization than the direct action. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. to make this effective. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of maybe the upcoming efforts to involve people that are want to plug into to your organization and what kind of things other people might be able to do to contribute?
Yes. So we have our first public meeting coming up on March 31st, and we would love to have all of the Kansas City community come out and join us. And that is if you have been involved in any of our activities thus far, whether or not you've come to our forums or if you've come to our direct actions. And even if you have not come to anything and you are just curious about One Struggle KC or Una Lucha KC, we would love for you to come.
Una Lucha, tell us just briefly what that is.
Well, three of the founding members of One Struggle are Latino, and I knew them through work in the immigrant rights movement. And so when we came together, we were very intentional about creating an organization that addressed issues affecting black people as well as the Latino community. And we wanted to be very deliberate in drawing that those intersections between, you know, our communities. And so when we formed, shortly after we formed One Struggle KC, we formed our sister organization called Una Lucha KC, which focuses specifically on issues affecting the Latino community, one of which is the situation in Ayotzinapa, Mexico, of the missing 43 students who were disappeared at the hands of the state. And we have some really exciting actions coming up this week regarding that on Tuesday and Wednesday.
Tell us a little bit more about that. And I believe Mr. Humfield is going to have a spot on that at the end of the show.
Right. And so we have some family members and classmates of the students that actually have gone missing. And so they will be here Tuesday and Wednesday, and I think they're going to go into details later on about the specifics of the events. However, so our efforts, that Una Lucha's efforts have been focused on that issue, and of course out of that comes transnational solidarity and, of course, connecting those struggles across borders.
All right, very good. Just briefly, can you give us a list of maybe other committees or ways people can get involved, and then I think we'll start allowing people to call in.
Yes, we'll go ahead and open the phone lines after that.
All right.
Okay. Yep, so at that public meeting, which is March 31st at 6 o'clock at in St. Andrew's United Methodist Church, 4601 Benton Boulevard, you will be able to, or we'll be introducing our committees, and some of our committees that you can join are, of course, Direct Action. We also have a Legal and Financial Committee. We have our base building, which is including everything from flyering to helping us to grow our volunteers. We also have a communications committee, which deals with our social media and website and all things related to communications. We also have education and training committee.
All right, very good. All right, so that is going to take place on the 31st at the, tell me again, the...
St. Andrew's United Methodist Church at 6 o'clock. And so we encourage everyone from the Kansas City community to come out to that. And there'll be a little bit more information. We'll be updating you on our upcoming events that'll be going on. So please come out.
All right. If you'd like to call in with questions, the number is 816-931-5534 for your questions for One Struggle KC. Tell us a little bit more about the effects of or why you need or going to have a committee related to communication and social media. What kind of things are you striving for in that area?
Well, a lot of our base building now has, up until this point, has been through social media. We've only been in existence since October, but we have over 1,300 people following us on Facebook. We have a Twitter account, and so that has been the most effective and direct way to reach people.
All right. As far as training, going back to, you said you'd done three types of training. Can you tell us a little bit more about the type of training you provide and how that might contribute to making people feel safer and more comfortable and understanding what to expect?
Well, we've had three direct action trainings, but we've also had a teach-in for Martin Luther King Weekend, and that was our Reclaim MLK. And the direct action training, of course, prepares you for protesting, but our teach-ins, which I think are extremely valuable, and people should be aware that we also provide those type, do a lot of historical trainings, letting people know about the history of marches and the educational aspect of participating in activism. And those are the future of One Struggle KC. We'll also be providing those on a variety of topics.
Tell us about the teach-in on Martin Luther King. What kind of things did you do? Who was kind of in charge of that?
Other members of the organization were in charge of that, but that was that, and we did some, there was a showing of Martin Luther King's speech, I think the last one prior to his assassination.
Where did this take place?
Southeast Community Center.
Okay.
And there was a lecture on the history of police brutality in the United States and how police brutality has been used to quash movements, liberation movements. The day also turned into, we also had some a yoga session because, you know, part of, it's good to be out in the streets, but you also have to implement self-care and make sure people can, you know, rejuvenate so that they can, you know, go back out there. And so we've actually had, we've incorporated a lot of several healing sessions into some of our events. We had two art healing sessions.
Tell us about an art, I'm sorry, let me give the phone number again, 816-931-5534. Again, if you have questions or comments for our guests, the number is 816-931-5534. Tell us a little more about the healing sessions, the art sessions, what kind of activities go on there.
In December, we had two art healing sessions, and we believe that there are many ways to heal from community violence, and so we wanted to create a safe space for people to express themselves, to sort of purge and come to terms with any sort of community level violence they've experienced. And so we had spoken word artists, we had visual artists, performance artists, but we also had a session where a portion of the session where people could write on what essentially was a graffiti wall and just you know, work out their emotions and feelings in that way, and that was very, very inspirational to see. We had artists create art there on the spot and donated to us, you know, for like our legal fund. And we also, of course, had a children's section where, you know, children could do the same. And so that's sort of actually involved into a project that Una Lucha has done, which is a children's coloring book that addresses the issues in Ayotzinapa. And so basically we want to make sure that we're taking care of the whole self.
Is that ongoing, or as far as the involving the spoken word artists, the visual artists, that type of thing?
Yes, we want that to be a regular thing, and actually we've just applied for a grant to continue that work.
All right, very good. I know there were some training. There was some training on the medical aspects, how to be prepared for certain kinds of contingencies. Okay. Before we go into that, I guess we do have a caller. Caller, can you give us your name and what part of town you're calling from?
Good morning. My name is Samantha Joyner. How are you?
I'm excellent. And you're calling from?
Bonner Springs.
Bonner Springs. Well, tell us what your question is.
I'm really interested on knowing about the group. I find that it would be wonderful for our family and what we've gone through with police brutality. And I guess my question to you is with the effects that this takes on people, what kind of groups and forms that you use and how it helps?
So basically, this goes to how to heal, perhaps, from if you've experienced police brutality. Thank you.
Well, as I was stating, we've had healing sessions to address that the emotional aspects of community violence and police brutality. And so, like I said, we want to continue to do that, but we also want to make sure that there is substantive change taking place. And so we've formulated demands that we intend to present to the police and the city, those in positions of power to affect real change on how police here, because we think that it's great to have these actions. It's great to have, healing sessions, but we need to make sure that actual change is taking place.
What kind of demands?
Excuse me. She's still.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Tell us about, in other words, you're saying it's not enough to just ask the community to heal and to adapt to, but to actually make changes and be specific about what changes need to be made. Tell us a little more about where you're headed in terms of what things need to be changed.
Well, certainly increase police accountability.
All right. How do you do that?
Well, we want to push for changes in the way that police who kill people are treated, to make sure that the officer's name is released, that details of the event are released, that there's transparency. And we don't feel that that is particularly the case here in the metropolitan area.
So what encounters, and I know this is just getting down to the nitty-gritty here, what needs to change? What have you been able to identify things that keep things, keep information away from the public that do not lend themselves to transparency, that could be changed in some way?
Well, I think that, for instance, we've made Sunshine Law requests.
All right.
And what we've gotten back is just sort of not a lot. And it calls the question whether, there is documentation happening and whether there is a good faith effort to maintain transparency with the public.
What kind of information are you seeking?
Basic information like, how many black people were killed or involved in police shootings last year.
Who have you sent those inquiries to?
To the police department itself.
Here in Kansas City, Missouri?
Right.
All right. And so have you gotten any response or just...
We have. All right. We have.
And what's that look like?
Not what we expected.
All right.
And so, you know, that's... We're still working through some of the information that we've received and letting that inform the demands that we're going to present.
And what about the structure, the laws themselves? Has there been efforts to look at, for example, the police officers, different rules apply to a situation of like self-defense or that type of thing? Are there different rules for, if I feel threatened, I have a right of self-defense. Is that different for police officers and should it be? Have you looked at in any of the laws in particular that might need to be changed?
Not particularly the self-defense laws. Now, I can reference a situation in Missouri where, for instance, in the Mike Brown case, there were erroneous laws presented to the grand jury in that, they were told or police apparently have been trained that it's okay to shoot someone when they're running away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that that is unconstitutional. And so, that's still happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so, situations like that are what we want to address.
Right. So it's not so much that the law, from what I hear you saying, it's already unconstitutional for someone to shoot someone simply because they're running. And we do see that a lot.
Right.
It's already kind of against the law, but it's still happening. So,
yeah, and from the facts that have been publicized regarding the police officer that recently was indicted here in Kansas City, Missouri, that man was running.
Mm-hmm.
He was running out of his house, and they still shot him
mm-hmm.
in the face.
Mm-hmm.
So issues like that are what we want to investigate and make sure that people's constitutional rights are not being violated by the police.
What about, have you... looked at or are you interested in sort of the idea that I believe is also coming out of Ferguson about the way that minority communities are really burdened with a lot of minor traffic infractions being stopped for that type of thing, targeting of communities, kind of like the stop and frisk situation in New York.
Yeah, absolutely. Racial profiling is a thing. And we've gone to community forums where a major in the Kansas City Police Department has admitted that racial profiling takes place. There's documentation that I believe the state has done itself that that proves that racial profiling does exist in Missouri.
The officer that admitted this, did he explain how it is, how's it done? Are they trained in a certain way that results in racial profiling? How's it carried out?
He didn't go into details. He just merely admitted and acknowledged that racial profiling takes place, that people are pulled over because of the color of their skin in Kansas City.
And That seems kind of a bold admission.
Yeah, I think we have it on video, actually.
How do you tackle that? How do you try to make some change in that?
I think you have to force change. And like I said, there is a report that was done by the state itself that shows that racial profiling takes place. And so The next question is, what do you do about it? What are we going to do to force the state to do something to address that?
Just a reminder that you're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio here on 90.1 FM, KKFI. And in the studio, we have Rebecca Hamilton, who is interviewing Kristen Chow and Brittany Coleman, who are the founding members of One Struggle KC. And we've been talking about how racism is institutionalized in our society in answering your questions as well. We just have a few more minutes for that. So if anyone did want to call in, 816-931-5534.
I don't know. I believe we actually talked about a book written by a KU professor called Pulled Over, which deals with these kinds of investigatory stops that are made as compared to an actual public safety issue, like perhaps speeding or running a red light, that actually we can say, yeah, those are the kind of traffic laws that do need to be enforced for the safety of the public, versus the you have a broken tail light, you know, you didn't signal your turn, lane change turn. His point seemed to be that there really wasn't conscious racial profiling, that was sort of no longer acceptable in police communities, but that it actually did occur, especially in the investigatory stop type of situation. In other words, his explanation was that it wasn't acceptable, but that it had occurred on an unconscious level because it was allowed.
Right. Implicit bias sounds like what's happening. Right. And, I think that's important to look at in police training, whether implicit bias is addressed and, that it's understood that it's you have to deal with that and fight against that. And you can't, pull people over because of some inherent bias you have.
Right. So it may not be that they're specifically saying, I'm going to pull this person over because they're Hispanic or black, but that it may be some inherent bias that they're not really aware of or acknowledging consciously.
Right.
So, all right. Thank you so much, both of you, for being our guests. It's been very informative, and we hope people will be there on the 31st and also become part of this very important group.
Right. And as I said, we're on Facebook as well if you want to check us out.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Jaws of Justice Radio. This is Jeff Humfeld, and you are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM. And my guest now is Melissa Stryler. I'll get it right. She is coordinator of the Cross Border Network for Justice and Solidarity. And the Cross Border Network is a grassroots organization. It's based here in Kansas City. It recognizes the common interest of working people in North America and tries to build ties for common action. And we're going to be talking about a caravan that is coming into Kansas City later today, a 43 parent or 16 parents of 43 Mexican children, school children that were kidnapped last September in Guerrero State, Mexico. Anyway, the caravan that is coming in is well, they have a couple, a number of different activities that they're going to do while they are here in Kansas City. That is a Tuesday tomorrow, at 10 a.m. There will be a press conference across the street from the Mexican consulate down at 16th and Baltimore in Kansas City, Missouri. They will be, letting the Mexican consulate that they know that they are here and that, people here in this country are also concerned about what has happened in Mexico. Then there at noon to 1 p.m., there will be a bilingual forum at the Ecumenical Campus Ministry at KU, down in Lawrence at 1204 Oread in Lawrence. And I believe we have our guest online now.
Melissa.
Hey. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, how are you?
Well, not too bad. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the caravan, why they're coming, why they're, Kansas City?
Sure. Well, here locally, Una Lucha and Cross Border Network and One Struggle have all been working together to bring the caravana up here. They're actually visiting 40 cities throughout the United States. Kansas City is the fourth stop, I believe, in one of three caravans that are going throughout the country. And they're coming to the United States because our government has played a huge role in enabling narco culture and not only allowing but creating the kind of environment where things like 43 missing students happens fairly normally, I mean, too often at least, in Mexico.
Okay, and it is the drug war here in the United States that has created these gangs down in Mexico, bringing the drugs across and the like. Why don't you tell us a little bit, I let people know about some of the events going on Tuesday. There is a second forum Tuesday afternoon or Tuesday evening down at El Centro. Now, that one is going to be in Spanish only, is that correct?
No, all of our forums, it's Spanish-focused, but all of our forums are going to be bilingual. All of our events are.
That's good. That's good to know. Spanish, the forum down at El Centro is from 7 to 9 p.m. tomorrow evening, and that's at 1330 South 30th Street in KCK down in Argentine. Why don't you tell us what's happening on Wednesday?
Well, Wednesday we have a rally and march starting at the Mexican consulate at 3:30 and ending at 6. This is going to be really important for people to turn out to because it's whenever we're dealing with both, through our march route, we're dealing with both the Mexican government and the United States government and really listing our demands and letting the voices of the families and fellow students of the missing 43 students be heard there. And then after that, we have a farewell dinner from 6:30 to 8:30 that's also bilingual at the Westside Can Center at 2138 or 30B Jefferson in Kansas City.
Okay. Very quickly, because we're out of time, can you give contact information if somebody wants to find out more?
Sure. They can give me, they can email me at melissa@crossbordernetwork.org. Or they can visit Cross Border Network or Una Lucha on Facebook.
Okie dokie. Melissa, we want to thank you very much for being on air today, and hopefully we'll get some folks out for this and make those connections with those parents that are suffering not only in Mexico but also here in the United States.
Great. Thank you so much.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following testimony was delivered this week to the Missouri Legislature by Thomas W. Mundell. He's a former member of the U.S. Army, serving as an Aero Scout gunner on hunter-killer assault teams, performing search-and-destroy missions in operations from Vietnam to Afghanistan. During his military career, he received the Silver Star, Distinguished Flying Cross, Bronze Star Medal for Valor, Air Medal for Valor, Army Commendation Medal for Valor, 4 Purple Hearts. Thomas W. Mundell.
Post-traumatic stress disorder. I have not met one veteran, and I have not met one individual. They all have a very distinct opinion that marijuana does reduce the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder unbelievably. And for someone that's been shot down 11 times, spent 17 months in the hospital, fought from Vietnam, 3 tours in Nam, 4 years in Iran, 2 years in Iraq, 17 months in Afghanistan, Pakistan, I'll be the last one on this earth to say I don't have a little bit of PTSD, but at least I have emotions now. And that's something I didn't have when I was fighting, when I was a warrior, because I just... You just can't do what I did for a living and really have emotions and do your job right. You just got to do it and deal with it later. My daughter's mother found me out in the garden one night at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I guess I was going through some kind of stupid head trip that I've always tried to hide from everybody. And I thought she was putting a cigarette in my mouth. And I pushed her away. I said, "Get that out of my face." And she goes, "Tom, you're dying. Something's going wrong. You need to relax. Please, just try this." I did. And for the first time in a long time, I started doing what I'm doing right now. I got emotional. I started caring, not only for others, but myself. It really relaxed me. And at that time, I will admit to you all here right now, I was on 71 pills a day. I was taking 41 in the morning and 30 at night, and I take 3 now. I'm not going to admit to anything else. And I've really come out of the closet on this one. But I felt that I needed to step up and be a man and be a leader.
It seems such a shame that a war hero would be afraid to speak the truth here in America. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
Ready? 1, 2, 3. Sitting here in my prime. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.
Well, I don't And if I fall down, I'm gonna get back up. It'll be alright. It'll be okay. Well, I'm gonna make my world a better place. Gonna keep that smile on my face. Gonna teach myself how to understand. Gonna make myself a better.